ॐ भद्रं कर्णेभिः शृणुयाम देवाः भद्रं पश्येमाक्षभिर्यजत्राः स्थिरैरङ्गैस्तुष्टुवांसस्तनूभिः व्यसेम देवहितं यदायुः स्वस्ति न इन्द्रो वृद्धः शवाः स्वस्ति नः पूषा विश्ववेदाः स्वस्ति नस्ताक्षुवरिष्ठनेमिः स्वस्ति नो बृहस्पतिर्दधातु ॐ शान्ति 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 ओ ऑलमाइटी लॉर्ड्स मे वी हियर विद आवर ईयर्स व्हाट इज ऑस्पिशियस मे वी सी एंड एक्सपीरियंस विद आवर आईज व्हाट इज ऑस्पिशियस मे वी वेल ऑफरिंग आवर प्रेज टू द लॉर्ड ऑलमाइटी With our body strong of limbs, enjoy the life which God is pleased to grant us. Om peace, peace, peace. We were discussing the 35th verse of the third chapter of Gaudapada's Kariga. This is a commentary on the Mandukya Upanishads in four chapters. And the verses from 34 till about 38, the point is made again and again that one should try to realize the unity of the universal Atman, the universal Self, and the individual Self, Jiva Brahma Ikyam, as it is called. Which is sometimes called samadhi, and the distinction, the differences between samadhi and deep sleep state, which is called sushupti in Vedantic language, stressed again and again. In sushupti, we feel that the mind is completely merged and mind becomes incapable of experiencing plurality and duality. But in samadhi, mind goes beyond the level of duality. Mind ceases to exist, which is called amani bhavam, the state where mind ceases to be mind. Mind becomes non-mind. And mind merges or becomes one with the Atman. This idea is stressed again and again. Now, this experience is called by one technical term in Mandukya Kariga. As you know, I already explained earlier, Gaudapada lived in the 6th century AD. And when he lived, Buddhism was very strong. The four schools of Buddhist philosophy were very prominent in India at that time. I mean, the four schools of later Buddhism. The two schools of realism and the two schools of idealism. Realism here implies a system of philosophy which believes in the reality of external objects. Idealism implies a system of philosophy which doesn't give status of reality, no ontological status of reality to external objects. That's the main difference. So when Gaudapada was living, he had to confront with the two schools of idealism, the Vijnanavada and the Shunyavada. Vijnanavada was the subjective idealism of Buddhists. Vijnanavadins believed, the subjective idealists believed in the non-reality of external objects. External objects, whatever we experience with our eyes, with our ears and mind, have no status of reality except depending upon the mind or the subject of witness. You see something, and the moment that image of that object vanishes from your mind, that object is as good as non-existent so far as you are concerned. That's why I said Vijnanavadins anticipated the views of Berkeley, who is the exponent of subjective idealism in our own times. In fact, Vijnanavadi, the Vijnanavada or the subjective idealism of Buddhism was much more profound. There are hundreds of works written on the subjects. And it was the raging, it was the most prominent school of thought for almost 400 years in India. Now, and Shunyavada, the doctrine of emptiness, which was expounded by Nagarjuna. Now, as I said earlier, Gaudapada uses many of these terms which were very common in Buddhist theology and philosophy. In fact, many of the terms which Gaudapada uses in this technical work are taken from the Buddhist subjective idealism, Vijnanavada, and the Buddhist nihilism, which is called Shunyavada, or the doctrine of emptiness. The early influence of Vijnanavada could be found in some prominent books written by anonymous writers like Lankavatara, and later Maitreyanada, Dingnaga, Vasubandhu, and a large number of them. Now, here in the 39th verse of the third chapter, he uses one term called Asparsha Yoga, which refers to a great spiritual mystical experience. Asparsha Yoga. The real meaning is this: a state of spiritual experience in which you are completely free from any attachment, any association with anything. You become yourself. You become aware of your own spiritual reality. You become aware of the fact that you are the universal supreme consciousness, which is not only omnipresent, all-pervading, but it's also the immanent indwelling spirit existing in everything in this world. Now, this is not an intellectual conviction, but it is an inner intuitive experience. This experience makes you feel free, completely free. It is a state of complete, absolute spiritual freedom. When you feel you are completely non-attached, you are not at all attached to anything in this world. You are the all-pervading, immanent, transcendental reality. The idea is taken perhaps from some of the verses from Bhagavad Gita, because in Bhagavad Gita, Asparsha Yoga, the term is not used, but the idea is sometimes mentioned, Eki Samsparsha Jabhoga, etc. Tam Vidya Dukkha Samyoga Viyogam, etc. Many such terms you find, and also in the second chapter, 14th verse, 5th chapter, 22nd verse, 5th and 6th chapter, 23rd verse. In all these verses, Lord Krishna deals with this inner intuitive mystical experience, which is a state of absolute and complete freedom. You are not bound by anything. And at this stage, one becomes completely free from fear. This is a state of absolute spiritual freedom. When you become completely free from the tyranny of your own senses, your own mind, your own intellect, when the mind is not tempting you, the mind is not bringing sensations of external objects, senses, temptations, attachments, desires, happiness, unhappiness, mind is not at all bringing any of these impressions or tendencies from external objects. And the five senses of perception have no contact with external objects. That is the state of complete freedom from the tyranny of the senses, which is a state of complete spiritual liberation. So when one is slave to the senses, it is spiritual slavery. When you are free from the tyranny of senses, it is spiritual freedom. This is what is meant by Asparsha Yoga. It's a very important theme which is special to this particular text of Gaudapada. Now, when we realize this unity with the entire cosmic reality, it is like waking up from slumber, from sleep. That is a technical term, anadi maya sukto, that you find in the first chapter. You find this verse. I shall briefly refer to that because it's a very prominent verse. Shankaracharya has written a very famous commentary on that. Shankaracharya says this spiritual awakening is like waking up from a deep slumber. Now, when you wake up from deep slumber, suddenly you realize where you are existing. Maybe in dream, you imagine yourself to be somewhere else. You have had a good lunch, you go to sleep, and you may experience terrible hunger in the dream, in your dream. When you wake up, suddenly you get liberated from hunger. You have no thirst when you are in waking state. You go to sleep and there you feel you are terribly thirsty and you go in search of water. But you suddenly wake up, the thirst has gone. Now, the question arises, what have you gained when you woke up? You have not gained anything. It's not a new knowledge that comes to you. You get away from the feeling. You are liberated from the feeling that you were hungry or thirsty. In fact, you are not hungry or thirsty because you had a full meal when you are dreaming, before you went to sleep. But in dream, you felt you are hungry. So when you wake up, you don't have to eat another lunch to be free from hunger because you had a full meal before you went to sleep. Now, so it's not a new knowledge. But in spiritual life, this needs a process. So, Gaudapada writes in the famous verse, in the first chapter, in the 16th verse, there is a famous description of this state. Now, Gaudapada writes here, anadi mayaya suktaha yada jiva prabuddhyate. So we are all completely, totally unaware of our true nature. So we think we are the psychophysical mechanisms. So we are bound. We are attached. So when we get something, we feel happy. And when we lose it, we feel unhappy. When we meet somebody, we are happy. And when that person leaves us, we are unhappy. So some yoga, viyoga means sukha, dukkha, means happiness, unhappiness, coming together and separation. All these are going on in our life. So we are in a state of flux, like a tiny boat that is tossed over by the mighty waves of destiny. Now, this state of normal human life is compared to deep sleep. Spiritually, we are in deep slumber. And because we are not aware of our true nature, we are in a state of deep sleep, deep ignorance. Is sleep, you know, sleep is associated with darkness. And darkness is associated with ignorance. So we are in total ignorance of our true nature. And this is anadi maya. This is the sleep. We don't know when it began. But it has an end. Something which we don't know when it began, but we are sure it's going to come to an end. This is called anadi maya. So Maya is something which is indescribable, which is beyond words. Anirvachaniya, Mahadbhudal, all these are terms are used by Shankaracharya. Something which is beyond definition, beyond description, beyond explanation, but very much a fact of our daily life. There are many things in this life. See, people want to avoid doing certain things. But then they can't help doing it. People want to do certain things, but they can never bring their mind to do that. So there is always an element of uncertainty. In spite of our best efforts, we can't do what we want to do. See, man can create a machine which will work, which will obey his dictations, his orders. But you can never be sure what we are going to do tomorrow, because our own mind is not within our control. We can create a mighty machine which is much more powerful, much faster than our mind. Perhaps supercomputers. But we can never really predict or determine how our mind is going to work. So that's why Vivekananda defined this Maya as a statement of fact. Something is very much a fact of our daily experience, but we cannot explain it. And we don't know when it began. So Anadi Maya Suptaha. So we are in deep slumber. And this sleep is imposed upon us by this Maya. So, and suddenly you wake up from this deep sleep. How we wake up from this deep sleep? Many people, if you read the lives of many great men, see Buddha's life, some time back we had a talk on Buddha's life here in San Francisco. See, Buddha was born as the prince. And when he was born, the astrologer predicted that this man, this boy is going to be, this baby is going to be an emperor. And so his father was very happy. But then the astrologer corrected him. He's not going to be the emperor in the empirical sense. He's going to be the emperor of ascetics. Means he will become an all-renouncing mendicant, which his father didn't like because he wanted somebody to succeed him to the throne. So this boy was brought up in an atmosphere of luxury, happiness and joy. But one day he was traveling, maybe his charioteer was taking him along the streets of Kapilavastu, the small town where he was born. And there he came across a sick man, then a dead body which being taken to the cremation ground, and an old man. So these three sides suddenly opened, it opened a tap within his mind. He was not allowed to know that there is such a thing as unhappiness in this world. And he saw an unhappy man, a sick man. He was not allowed to know the unpleasant fact that everyone will get old and one day die. Suddenly he was forced to open his eyes, because he saw a sick man in a miserable condition. So he knew, well, my youth won't last long. If this man can get sick, I too may get sick one day. And then he saw a dead body being taken in a procession to the cremation ground. So if this man dies, well, I also will certainly die. I am a man, I am a human being as much as he, this dead man. So that struck a note within his mind. Something happened within him. Something hit his mind, and there is an opening. And that day, that night rather, he left his home, his palace, his comforts, his kingdom, his young wife and a small baby who was his son, Rahul. And that made him a Buddha. So you can imagine. So the 28-year-old young prince who was never allowed to know what it was to be sick, to be unhappy and to die, suddenly was forced to open his eyes to the fact that every human being will have to confront this fate, death and unhappiness. And that snapped something in within him. And he left his kingdom and he became Buddha after a long penance. Now, he suddenly woke up his mind, woke up. Anadi Maya Suptaha. He was sleeping for 28 years. And this experience had the effect of awakening him. This could happen to many people. But for many people, some kind of help is necessary. Maybe reading a holy book, a great book, something, a book that tells us the reality of human existence can certainly have the effect of forcibly opening our eyes to the reality of human life and human death also. And sometimes it may take a great teacher who needs to explain to you, well, there is such a thing as the immortal, eternal Atman, and this body which is born, which grows, which falls sick and dies, is not all that exists. There is something beyond this body, which is eternal, everlasting, which is not bound by any of these laws of birth, existence, or death, which is eternal, which is ever unborn, and because it always exists, so it can never take birth and it can never die. Now, this is dramatically brought out by the great commentator Shankaracharya, who actually brought out the philosophical and spiritual implications of this great text in Sanskrit language by writing a commentary. He brought out this meaning. So, I shall just read some portions of his text and then we'll explain. So, the verse is this. It comes in the first chapter, 16th verse. Anadi maya suptaha yada jiva prabuddhyate. So, this individual self, human being, sleeping under the influence of Maya, that unpredictable, indeterminable power, which is called Maya, which I have explained, which is beginningless, but which has an end. So, and that jiva, that individual self is awakened. Suddenly he gets up and opens his eyes. And he realizes, well, I'm not this physical body. Suffering, miseries, and enjoying for some time, and then suffering for some time. Being born, and then dying, and then reborn. I'm not the psychophysical mechanism. But I am that reality which is never born, and therefore which is never dead. It is unborn, ajam, anidram, asuptam, advaitam. I am not this physical body, but I am that unborn, the eternal, the everlasting, the sleepless, the dreamless, the non-dualistic consciousness, Atman, Brahman. This realization alone can give us complete freedom from fear. That is the point which Gaudapada is going to stress again and again. Complete freedom from fear. Your fear is so much a part of human existence that we can never get rid of it. So long as we believe we are this body. Because everything that human beings do is to gain freedom from fear. Fear can take the form of restlessness. See, people want to run away from themselves. You can find. They want to forget. So often, they want to forget the problems of their life. In deep sleep, you can get a bit of this. But that is natural state in which you are rendered incapable of experiencing the reality of problems around you, which you have to face in waking state. So in deep sleep or susupti, you lose your ability to experience the problems in this relative world, happiness, unhappiness, death of friends, loss of money, loss of status. All these problems cease to exist. They vanish in deep sleep. But the problems are not solved. You are able to forget these problems for a short time. And for that, people take drinks also. They take drugs also. they take so many means, so many other sometimes undesirable, questionable means are also adopted by people to forget the problems of the relative world. All are attempts to get freedom from fear, freedom from misery. People take to drinks, it is an attempt to forget and to free themselves from misery. But when the effect of the drinks is gone, it comes back with a vengeance. People take to hobbies. People take to drugs. All these are attempts to run away from oneself. Because the mind is torturing. In psychiatry is called, conflict solutions. Internal conflict, mind itself has got a mechanism of projecting certain delusions and illusions as conflict solving mechanisms in psychiatry. But all these attempts will become total failures unless we take our life to spiritual channel. Now, in this commentary, Shankaracharya says the real solution to all the problems comes only when we go beyond the wrong notion. When we get away from the wrong notion, when we remove the wrong notion that we are this body, we are the psychophysical mechanisms. The commentary says, Yoyam samsari jivaha saubhe lakshanena tattva apradibodha rupena bijatmana anyatha grihana lakshanena cha anadikala pravurtena maya lakshanena sopnena mamayam pida putroyam naptaksh Kshetram, Pashavo, Ahamesham, Swami, Sukhi, Dukhi, Kshaitoham, Anena, Vardhidascha, Anena, Ittevam, Pragaran, Swapnan, Sthanadduyi, Api, Pasyan, Suptaha. So, the life is a very long sentence. I shall explain in English. Human existence, human life is explained here. What is the condition of an ordinary human being's life? He thinks, I am his son. I am his father, this property is mine. All these are explanations here. So, I have gained this, so I am happy. I have lost this, I am unhappy. All these are explaining. Sukhi, dukhi, kshaitaha, aham anena vartitascha. I have got a lot of money, so I am happy. I lost the money, I am unhappy. He is my father. I am his son. This is my field. This is my property. So, these associations with constantly changing, fleeting, relative entities in this empirical world, get us bound to these shackles of attachment. So, we are in a miserable condition. From a spiritual point of view, remember it's only from a spiritual point of view. From a spiritual point of view, a person who thinks he is just this psychophysical mechanism is in deep slumber from a spiritual point of view. Then how does he or she wake up? So, the great philosopher Shankaracharya says, Yada Vedantartha Tattva Abhijnena Paramakarunikena Guruna Nasyevam Tvam Hedu Phalatmaha Kimtu Tattva Masidhi Pradibuddhimanaha Tadevam Pradibuddhide. He gets up, he wakes up when a teacher tells him, when a great teacher tells him, you are not the psychophysical mechanism. You are not this tiny boat which is tossed over by the mighty currents of destiny, suffering, enjoying for some time, suffering for a longer period, suffering when something is lost, enjoying momentary happiness when something is gained. You are not this helpless, hapless, tiny bird that is tossed over by the mighty currents. You are the Atman. You are the eternal Atman, the supreme reality, the absolute reality. You are the Brahman, which is everlasting and eternal, which has no end. So if money is lost, you are not going to lose anything. If you gain money, you are not going to gain anything. Because these things come and go. They are not eternal. They are not everlasting. But you, the Atman, you, the Brahman, you, the Supreme Consciousness, is everlasting, eternal, and your true nature is existence absolute, knowledge absolute, bliss absolute. Once this realization, not conviction, once this realization comes, that moment you wake up. Somebody may ask this question. If it is just a matter of inner intuitive experience, what's the use of discussion, lectures, reading scriptures? This question may arise. Right now, we are fully convinced, ordinarily, people are fully convinced that they are not Atman, that they are the psychophysical mechanism, they are the body. That is the present condition. They are strongly convinced they are not Atman, they are not Brahman, they are only physical bodies. That is the present state of affairs. Now, if we go on reminding ourselves by reading, by listening, by contemplation, by meditation, by deep thinking, if we go on keeping our mind associated with the idea that we are not just this enjoying and suffering body and mind, we are something beyond all this, we are the eternal everlasting reality. If intellectually at least, if we can go on reminding ourselves of this supreme truth, it slowly helps us to approach this experience. That's the idea behind. If not in this life, in the next life. That's why I referred to this earlier. One may ask this question. Well, you may go on reading these books, listening, you may go on listening to these ideas, reading holy books and contemplation. And if it is just a matter of inner experience, when it is going to happen, that question may arise. In fact, in the 6th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, Arjuna puts his question to Krishna. His question is very simple. Krishna taught him the science and the method of meditation. And then Arjuna asked the question, suppose somebody fails to achieve this goal. Well, you go on reading, you go on meditating, but you are not fully successful in getting the conviction, or people die away. They die before they reach this goal. Does it mean that everything will be lost? That's the end of the journey. Now, if you believe that life is a linear, straight line progression, at the end of the journey, you are admitted to heaven or admitted to hell. Now, Vedanta doesn't agree with this view. Vedanta believes in the cosmic existence of the universe and also jivas, human beings. So, Arjuna's question is this: Ayadi Sadhayopedu Yoga Chalidamanasaha Aprapi Yoga Samsiddhim Kam Gatim Krishna Gachati. A very simple question. He's addressing Krishna, his teacher. Ayati means somebody who is not successful in controlling the senses. He has got great concentration. Sadhayopeta means he has got a lot of concentration, great respect for spiritual life, is trying to practice spirituality. But then, he is not fully successful. But then what happens? He had a fall or he had a deviation. Yoga chalida manasaka. Mind gets deviated from the path of yoga. Now, what is going to happen to him? What is going to be his fate? Kam gati means, what is going to be his fate? Gati means destiny. If you believe in linear progression, as I mentioned earlier, well, there is total despair. Only one chance. If you are successful, all right, the heaven's gates are open before you. If you are not 100% successful, if you get only 99% marks, you go to hell. This is extremely cruel thing. Perhaps, you know, that's why very often, you know, people find it very difficult to reconcile with the idea of an all-merciful God and a cruel world. If God is so compassionate, why should the world be so cruel? Vivekananda, before he came in contact with Sri Ramakrishna, before he got spiritual enlightenment, used to ask this question to himself. He was an agnostic, Swami Vivekananda. Now, in answer to this question, Krishna gives a very wonderful answer. In essence, his answer is this. Whatever little effort you make in spiritual life, if you meditate for 1 minute in your whole life, if you read one page from a holy book, if you concentrate even for 1 minute in your whole lifespan, that effort will not be lost. That effort, even a little bit of spiritual practice, will remain in your account. And when you die, in your next life, you can draw your check on this deposit. Means, next life, the benefit, the merits of this spiritual practice, whatever little you have done, if you listen to a good lecture, and if, with concentration, if you register some of the ideas in your mind, that will save you. That will help you to continue your spiritual journey forward till you reach your destination. That is Krishna's answer. So, Partha Naiveha Namutra Vinashas Tasya Vidyate Nahi Kalyana Krut Kaschim Durgatim Tata Gacchati. Krishna tells Arjuna, now look here Arjuna, Kalyana Krut Kaschim means anyone, any spiritual seeker, who has done a little bit of spiritual practice. It need not necessarily be a long penance, long meditation, total renunciation, total surrender. Need not necessarily be. But even little bit of that, if you do, that person will be saved. And it is very difficult to find anybody in this world who has not done even little spiritual practice. Just as it is very difficult to find anybody who has done only spiritual practice. Both extremes are there. So, Krishna tells, in the next life, tatradam buddhisam yogam labhate paurvadekhikam. That's what Krishna says. Tatradam buddhisam yogam labhate paurvadekhikam. The person who does something good in this life, his samskaras and tendencies will continue with him. Whatever little spirituality has practiced with the body belonging to previous life. Paurvadekhikam means the body related to previous life. That buddhi, those tendencies, samskaras, all these will remain with him and it will help him in his next life. So, Shankaracharya says, a little bit of this practice will help you to continue your spiritual journey forward and move you forward. That's the idea behind. So, this Asparsa Yoga is an important theme in this Gaudapada Kairika, which is mentioned in the 39th verse of the 3rd chapter. Now, in the 40th verse, the same idea continues. These ideas are sometimes repeated in very many verses continuously. Manaso nigrahayattam abhayo sarvayoginam dukkhakshaya prabodhascha pyakshaya shantirevacha. When the same idea, the eternal peace, the eternal happiness, complete freedom from dukkha, grief, and complete enlightenment comes only when you succeed in controlling your mind. The idea is repeated. In the 41st verse, there is an interesting idea. Not because it is a new idea, but a new analogy, new illustration is presented. Very forceful imagery. Forceful illustration and imagery are mentioned here in the 41st verse. Utsega udadher yadvat kushagrena ekabintuna manaso nigrahas tadvat bhavet aparikhedata. This is the 41st verse. The prose order will be something like this. Yadvat kushagrena ekabintuna udadhihi utsekaha tadvat aparikhedata manasaha nigrahaha bhavet. Well, now a subject is being presented here. How do we succeed in controlling our senses and mind so that we realize that we are not the psychophysical mechanism, so that we reach this state of Asparsha Yoga explained in the 39th verse? So here is an imagery. Suppose you take the smallest possible bit of dry grass and then try to empty the water in the ocean. It is a very kind of an imagery, an illustration. You have to work very hard and you will require infinite patience, tenacity, and perseverance. Now, Gaudapada says, with the same tenacity and perseverance, if you strive to reach the supreme spiritual goal, you will succeed. Here, the stress, the emphasis is on the need for tenacity and perseverance and patience and steady effort. That's the idea behind. How much steadiness, tenacity, and perseverance are required to empty the ocean? If you go on removing the water with the smallest dry grass, it's almost impossible. But still, if somebody tries that, thinking that one day he will succeed in emptying the ocean, it's not going to happen. What amount of patience he will need, he'll require. That kind of patience is required in spiritual life. It is not a pessimistic picture. The idea is this. People sometimes ask the question, well, I have done my best, still I feel restless, I feel unhappy, etc. In fact, unhappiness and restlessness, which are felt even after taking up spiritual life, are different from the unhappiness and restlessness felt by those who have not even started the journey. There is a basic qualitative difference between the two. So that these ideas are stressed again and again. In the 42nd verse, Upayena nigrhiniyat vikshiptam kama bhogayohu suprasannam laye chaiva yatha kamo layastatha. The idea is repeated here. Mind is sometimes tempted in physical and intellectual and mental pleasures and pleasantries. Mind may forget the unpleasant realities of empirical life in deep sleep. But that forgetfulness doesn't spiritually help us much. What is needed is to reach a state when you completely transcend the empirical existence, the empirical level. That's the idea behind. Now, today, of course, there is an important information for you. This is the last class before the summer recess. The next class will be on Friday, September the 13th, 2013. So, we'll have no class till Friday, September 13th. So, I would rather invite those of you who are interested to ask questions, those who want clarifications on what I have discussed today, or on what I have discussed all these days, or on spiritual subject in general. You can ask questions. If there is any clarification required, I shall try to respond to that. because this is going to be the last class of this session. So, Shankaracharya has written a commentary on Mandukya Karika. So I was quoting from his Karika. Sorry, his Bhashya. Bhashya means commentary in Sanskrit. Because the Karikas are only verses, four-line verses, very brief verses. So the full spiritual and metaphysical import of these verses is brought out by the great commentator Shankaracharya. So the description and spiritual principle underlying these verses are brought out by Shankaracharya in his commentary. If you want to get a deeper understanding, those of you who cannot read original Sanskrit can get translations. They are available. Translations are available. Yes. Yes. He translates. Yes. All this work, Gita, the 10 Upanishads, Brahma Sutras, all the spiritual and the metaphysical implications of all the whole these texts were brought to the surface by Shankaracharya. Without Bhashyas, with Bhashyakara's words, you won't be able to understand even a part of the spiritual implication behind. Any other? If you don't have any doubts, then I can complete that commentary, because the commentary is something very interesting, very illuminating. I can because here the Bhashyakara gives a graphic description of how this realization comes. So I already explained earlier, the great teacher comes and tells the spiritual aspirant, the spiritual seeker, you are struggling, you are in this miserable state because you think the worldly pleasures are the only thing to be achieved. So when you get them, you are happy, and when you don't get them, you are unhappy. So you are a slave of happiness and unhappiness, as I said earlier, like a helpless boat, tiny boat, which is tossed over the mighty currents of the ocean. It cannot enjoy happiness or rest. Now, katham, then the commentator asks the question, how does it happen? What is the instruction which the teacher gives the student? Nasmin bahim abhyantaram va janmadi bhava vikaraha asti ataha ajam sabahyabhyantara sarva bhava vivarjitam ityartha. Now, the teacher tells the student, right now the student is unhappy, happy and unhappy. He is miserable. He enjoys for some time, and enjoyment can never be everlasting. When it comes to an end, he becomes miserable. This is the normal state of human existence. One can never be happy, eternally happy. Gita uses the term atyantikam dukkham, sukham atyantikam yadvat buddhigrahi matindriyam. The real sukha, the real happiness, the real pleasure, the real restfulness, the real relaxation and relief come only when you stop seeking happiness. The best way to get happiness is to stop seeking happiness. Because whatever happiness we are seeking in this world is empirical happiness, worldly happiness, which can never be everlasting. People work for money. Before they get money, they are unhappy because they don't have money. When they get money, they are unhappy because they are afraid money may get lost one day. That is also a state of anxiety, and anxiety is certainly a state of unhappiness. And one day it will be lost. empirical pleasures can never be everlasting. It comes and it goes. So then also unhappiness. So unhappiness is the state of human mind before getting the objects of happiness. And also after having got the objects of happiness and after having lost them. Now how to get real happiness, true happiness, everlasting happiness? To understand that one should go beyond happiness and unhappiness. So the only way to go beyond unhappiness is to stop seeking happiness. And that is possible only when we realize that we are not the psychophysical mechanisms. So long as we are convinced, we are under the delusion that we are the physical bodies, we will be seeking these fleeting objects of happiness. And there will be no happiness, no real happiness in our life. Because what we normally call happiness in the worldly sense is only one side of the coin. The other side is unhappiness. So, the teacher tells the student, you are not this psychophysical mechanism. There is no modification in you. You are not these external or internal entities which comes and goes, which has got a birth and death. Rather, you are that reality which is in fact eternal, everlasting, which is unborn and therefore which is immortal. Anything which is born will die. So the only reality which is immortal is the reality which is never born. So that teaching is imparted by the teacher to the student. And after getting this instruction, the student, the spiritual seeker, the spiritual aspirant should try to reinforce his mind with this idea, should meditate on this idea. He has to play his own role in making this idea his own. The teacher can give you an instruction, but the instruction that you get becomes yours only when you make proper use of it. So there is a human effort and also God's grace or whatever you may call it. Human effort has got an important place in spiritual life. So there is in the sixth chapter of Chandogya Upanishad, there is a story. I won't go into those details. The illustration comes there also. The illustration involves a great teacher and how the teacher instructs the disciple. It comes in the sixth chapter in which Uddalaka instructs his son and disciple Shvetaketu. The great statement that you are the Atman Tattvamasi, this idea is taught. You are that. Now, here, the role of a teacher is emphasized with the help of an illustration. A traveler is passing through a forest, a deserted forest. Alone, he is traveling. And he had a bundle with him. He has some money, some belongings. Some robbers waylay him. He is waylaid. He is ambushed. He is robbed of all his belongings. And his eyes are bound, tied with a cloth. Then he is tied to a tree and the robbers go away. Now, this wayfarer, the poor traveler, he is in a state of total misery. He cries and weeps and he shouts. Now, another traveler was he came that way. He is a compassionate person. And he heard this poor man's cries and wailings. He comes to him. He unties the bondage and he frees him. He removes the bandage from his eyes. And then the poor man tells his story. Some robbers ambushed him, waylaid him. He's coming from Gandhara country, a distant place. He's on his way to that place. No, I do not know, because the robbers took me away from the main road. So I don't know which way to go back, which road I should take to reach my home. Now this compassionate traveler tells him, well, you follow this path. And after some time, you may find a village. You can ask people living in that village. And they will guide you. They will give you more instruction. They will guide you. And you can continue your journey from place to place. Now, the teacher gives the instruction. The teacher liberates the poor traveler from his bondage. He unties him. He takes away the cloth that is with which his eyes are bound, and then tells him, you follow this track, this path, this road, you can reach your home. That much only a teacher can do at the most. It is a traveler's duty to follow that road which the teacher has shown him. And after some time, he may reach a village. Then he may find some people living in that village. He can ask, I'm on my way to Gandhara country. How should I proceed? Then he may reach a junction perhaps. Four roads will be there in the junction. Which way to turn, he may not be sure. So he'll ask somebody else, which road should I take to reach my place? But this is his duty, to use his discrimination and to find the right type of person. Some people may mislead you, so you have to get the right type of person, ask for instruction and follow his instructions. Slowly you will reach your goal. So the teacher tells the student, the spiritual seeker, gives the instruction. The spiritual seeker should use his or her wisdom and discrimination, intelligence, think and pursue the path. He should constantly read spiritually useful books. He should get his mind reinforced with spiritually elevating ideas. He should renew his familiarity with these spiritual ideas by constant reading, contemplation, meditation. So he should put forth his own effort. So human effort is as important as teacher's instruction, or you may say God's grace. Both are equally important. In the writings of Saint Teresa of Avila, there is a wonderful reconciliation between human effort and God's grace. It's not a Vedantic book, but it is certainly Vedantic in another sense, because it also deals with the ultimate spiritual destiny of human existence. But there, instead of Vedantic approach, God's grace is emphasized. So Saint Teresa of Avila gives an illustration in her writings. Suppose you are a farmer, if you are farming the land, and the field is not ready, if there are pebbles and stones and undesirable grass and weeds, you have to remove all this, then only you can start your agricultural activities. And you want to bring water to the field. There is a river, maybe a pond, a well, or some other reservoir from where you want to bring water. So you can use any means to bring water. You can bring water in a pond, which is very tedious. You can cut a canal, or you can use a water mill, whatever may be. That's what she mentions, because she lived in the early days, centuries ago. So, all these are efforts which may help you to irrigate the field. But before you bring water, before you irrigate the field, you must get the field ready for irrigation. How do you do that? You must remove the pebbles and stones and weeds and undesirable growth of grass. All these things should be removed from the field, and the field should be made ready for irrigation. Before the field is ready, if you irrigate the field, grass also will grow, weeds also will grow. And maybe the pebbles and stones may stifle the sprouts, the seeds, as mentioned in Jesus' parable of sower of seeds. So, the spiritual seeker has to work and he has to play his own role. Before he or she starts the irrigation process, bringing water, the field should be made ready by removing all weeds and grass and pebbles and stones. Then you can irrigate the field. Then she says, suppose it starts raining. That's the best way of irrigating the field. Whatever other means you may use for irrigating the field, bringing water with a pond or by cutting a canal or through water mill, whatever may be. All these are good, but if it starts raining profusely, there is no better way of irrigating the field. That is God's grace. But if it starts raining before the field is ready, it is no use, because weeds will grow, grass also will grow, seeds won't sprout. So before God's grace comes, the field should be made ready. Another problem is, if we don't put up our own effort, we won't be able to recognize or appreciate God's grace. If suddenly God appears before you, if people don't really bother much about spiritual ideas, if God appears, I shall give you a realization, I don't need it right now. That will be natural human response. People who are not intensely devoted, who are not intense spiritual seekers, even if God appears before them, it's no use. Similarly, before the field is ready, even if it starts raining, it won't help. So field should be made ready. And our effort, our meditation, our listening to spiritual talks, lectures, reading, contemplation, introspection, meditation, all these correspond to the effort involved in making the field of our mind ready for spiritual irrigation. That is the idea behind. So in the Christian mystical works, you can see the reconciliation between human effort and God's grace. In Vedantic texts, which are basically non-dualistic in nature, at the metaphysical level, it is mentioned, a teacher should instruct you. But then the teacher, one should not think without, I didn't get a teacher, so I have no future. No. Human effort itself, they will take you to the ultimate goal if there is sincerity and purity of mind behind it. That's the idea behind. So thank you. So we will have the next class, as I mentioned earlier, on September the 13th. So we'll begin the summer recess. So I wish all of you a happy summer holiday. Thank you. Namaskar. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti.